This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about policing in New York City and its implications around the country.
500,000 people stopped on the streets of New York in 1 year. It's a legal and political outrage.
In preparation for the Republican National Convention, it's come out that New York City police were spying on peace groups internationally and around the country.
What else is new? We've all known this for a long time. But finally, some documents are surfacing that indicate widespread surveillance by your very finest, the NYPD.
We'll tell you the latest news from Guantanamo.
The military commissions have begun. They're as bad as we all thought, and the government even got a guilty plea. Stay with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
As I'm sure most of our listeners know, last week, David Hicks, an Australian imprisoned at Guantanamo, pleaded guilty before a military commission to one charge of giving material aid to terrorism. David Hicks was actually the Center for Constitutional Rights' first client. I remember actually the day on January 2002 when I made the call to his attorney in Australia, and the center offered to represent him, who was one of the, he was on the first plane that actually went to Guantanamo. He's been there for 5 years, never had a trial, and so this was his opportunity to actually present himself before this military commission, certainly not a court. We're going to discuss that case, and I have with me Dahlia Hashad from Amnesty International, our co-host, who has also been working on the issue of military commissions at Amnesty. When you heard that David Hicks had pled guilty, what did you think?
Well, I mean, it was a very disturbing day. I think the proceedings from beginning to end were nothing short of horrifying if you care anything about legal process and human rights. What we saw was David Hicks, much changed from the pictures that we had seen, walk into the courtroom in flip-flops with hair hanging down halfway down his back. Apparently, he's grown his hair out because while we'd been told that this Australian was being purposefully kept out of the sunlight and he hadn't seen the sun in years, that doesn't mean he's been in the dark. They keep the lights on in his cell 24 hours a day so he won't be able to sleep. So he's grown his hair down to the middle of his back so that he can wrap it around his face and try to get some sleep. He came in and he sat down next to his three defense attorneys, Rebecca Snyder, Josh Dreitel, who we had on the show a couple weeks ago talking about this very case, and our friend Major Dan Morey, whom we've had on the show before. He immediately told the judge, the military judge, Marine Colonel Ralph Coleman, he wanted his defense attorneys provided with more assistance. He said, the prosecution has all those lawyers. I need an equal defense, and I'm not provided with one.
Not only did he not get as many lawyers, yeah. What happened, though?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The first thing that happened was that Rebecca Snyder, one of his lawyers, was removed from the case. The military judge, Colonel Coleman, said that because she was a civilian in the reserves, she couldn't represent him, saying that she had to enlist, I guess. Is that right?
Something like that. He was dead wrong on his ruling, but
Rebecca could stay and consult, but not advocate on his behalf. Essentially, he said, do you want her to just stay and do nothing? And David Hicks said, no, I don't want her to stay and do nothing. She's going
to
leave.
I want her as my lawyer, but she's not being allowed to be my lawyer. So that's one of the three lawyers gone.
And
next,
then,
Dahlia?
Well, Josh Dreitel. Josh Dreitel was disqualified from representing David Hicks because he refused to agree to procedural rules that were supposed to be set out by Rumsfeld, I believe. Rumsfeld has failed to set out these procedural rules. What the military judge said is, well, I'm going to draft these. I drafted these military rules, and you can sign on to these. Josh refused to sign them because he said, look, the rules that I'm supposed to sign on to are supposed to be created by Donald Rumsfeld, and you're not authorized to create these rules. So essentially, what I'd be agreeing to are rules that haven't even been drafted, and I can't, as an attorney, agree to abide by procedural rules that I haven't seen. And he was disqualified.
And what he said was, it's unethical for him to do so because he'd be signing a piece of paper that said he would obey rules that haven't been written. And some of those rules, for all you know, could prohibit private communication with his client, as he said, and other reasons. So he said, it's unethical for me to sign these rules. So that means out of three attorneys, now we're down to one attorney.
Well, what Josh, I want to go back to Josh Dreitel, and what he said was, Colonel Coleman, who's the military judge in this case, said, do you want to David Hicks, do you want Mr. Dreitel to sit at your side? But again, he won't be able to advocate on your behalf as a lawyer would. And so David Hicks said, you know, no. And Josh Dreitel said, I'm not a potted plant. He's not going to sit there as decoration for a process that occurs in a legal vacuum. What's really horrible is David Hicks started the day saying, I need more attorneys to adequately represent me. This is not okay for my legal team to sit here and be faced with the enormous arsenal that the U.S. government is throwing at us, and we only have three. The judge's response to that was to whittle his attorneys down to one. And at the end, David Hicks said, I'm shocked because I just lost another lawyer, referring to Josh Dreitel. And he said, now I'm left only with, quote, poor Mr. Morey.
Right. Now, poor Mr. Morey happens to be a very strong, interesting military attorney who himself has come under incredible attack from the government for being an aggressive lawyer on behalf of David Hicks. In fact, the prosecutor in this very case said that perhaps that Colonel Morey should face a Uniform Code of Military Justice, a court-martial, for some of the statements he's made calling these trials kangaroo courts. So here you have Major Morey doing his job, calling these courts what they are, and the very prosecutor who's prosecuting the case says, I'm going to go after you, Major Morey. And Morey's sitting there with this then his own ethical dilemma because he says, I have to do this for my client, but they're facing me with a criminal charge if I vigorously defend them.
That's
so they
right.
got rid of Dreitel. They got rid of the
Rebecca Schneider.
Rebecca, and then they go after Morey.
And then what the judge did was Major Morey, he put forth a motion challenging the military judge's fitness to preside over the hearing, saying that there is both bias and the appearance of bias, which I think from what we've heard, we can agree with him. The military judge ruled himself fit to preside over the proceedings. So it's good to know that the military judge has said, I'm just fine to preside over these proceedings and there's no problem here. The first part of the day's proceedings was very upsetting and incredibly worrisome.
Happened. No, bizarre, but unfortunately with these military commissions, which are really, they're not courts at all, they're really show trials, is really unfortunately it was par for the course, Dahlia, I think.
I was incredibly disheartened. And then David Hicks did plead guilty to providing material support for terrorism. He pleaded not guilty to the second charge, which was providing material support or resources for an act of terrorism. Do you know the difference, Michael?
Well, because in fact, David Hicks never did an act of terrorism. The claim here is that he trained in an Al-Qaeda camp and that that was supporting, giving material support to a terrorist organization. He then tried to, apparently, according to the government, go fight alongside the Taliban, but never succeeded in getting there. His history is very interesting in this respect. He was picked up by the Northern Alliance or somebody like that, never shot a gun, never fired a gun, and was eventually taken to Guantanamo after going a trip to Kandahar first, trip to U.S. aircraft carrier, a trip to the land, beaten pretty badly on different occasions.
I mean, he alleges that he was sodomized. He alleges that he was beaten, forced to take unknown injections. He was tortured on a variety of levels even before he got to Guantanamo. And we know that what has happened in Guantanamo is torture, and you don't have to take our word for it. You take the FBI's word for it in their documents that they have drafted.
Right. So you look at this one charge, material aid to terrorism. There's a few things to say about it. First, the facts of David's case, which we've just talked about briefly. But there was an interesting article in the New York Times by Ray Bonner that talked a little bit about David Hicks. David, first of all, he was what's called a roustabout in Australia, kangaroo skinner, you know, sort of young man looking for his place, eventually went and fought on behalf of Muslims in Kosovo with the United States. He then, after that war is over, he goes to Pakistan, and there, according to the Bonner article, Pakistan intelligence, not
our allies.
Our allies sends him, this ISI it's called, sends him to be trained with Al-Qaeda in a camp so that he can then fight on behalf of Pakistan against India in the Kashmir dispute. That's this guy's relationship to so-called supporting a terrorist group. Pakistan intelligence sending him to be trained to fight for them in Kashmir.
And the time period that the military commissions is concerned about runs from his activities in December 2000 to December 2001. The allegation is that he intentionally provided material support for Al-Qaeda, and he did this during a period of armed conflict. Yet the armed conflict in Afghanistan did not begin until the end of that time period where they're accusing David of this activity. It didn't begin until October 2001. What is interesting about the military commissions is that they effectively backdate the war on terror. They backdate the war on terror. It didn't begin until October 2001. They backdate it so that offenses committed before October 2001, before the so-called war on terror, are criminal under their crazy rules.
The facts of what he pleaded guilty to me are in question, but then there's other questions. One is the charge, materially aiding a terrorist organization. First of all, we try people in the United States under that charge all the time in our regular criminal courts. So you might ask yourself, why is David Hicks being tried before some kangaroo court in Guantanamo with no real right to lawyers, with no right to exclude hearsay evidence, with the government allowed to use torture evidence? Why isn't he tried in a criminal court? And why are some people in his same situation supposedly tried in a criminal court here? That's one big question. Another big question about the charges. A second one is military commissions. We can talk a lot about military commissions, but one of their restrictions is they have to be used to prosecute war crimes. Aiding a terrorist organization has never been a war crime. It was recently made up to be a war crime. So they actually got him to plead guilty to something that isn't even authorized to be tried by a military commission. So it's quite extraordinary what is going on here.
And they got him to plea, but they trot this out like getting him to plea to this material support charge is a great victory. But look at the alternatives that he was facing. They're telling him that, look, you might face a lifetime in prison. And under the conditions that he's faced at Guantanamo, where he hasn't seen the light of day, he hasn't seen his family, he has two young kids in Australia. And what they have said to him is that if you plea, you might be able to get 20 years, and maybe we'll give you time already served, so that would be 5 years off your sentence, and we'll send you back to Australia, where you can be in the same country, in the same vicinity as your family and your two young children, whom you have not seen in 5 years.
I think that both what you're saying in terms of the overall picture and then the immediate picture. The immediate picture is he's sitting in court. I don't know if on that day when he took the plea that he was really ready to take the plea, but when he saw the two of his attorneys were taken out of the courtroom, essentially, his other attorney's been viciously attacked. He sees a judge who's clearly, the only word is a hanging judge for that guy, and he's saying to himself, you know, what am I doing here? That's the short term, and the long term is the point you're making. He's been in Guantanamo since January 11th, 2002. And if he is convicted by this court in a so-called way that isn't pleading guilty, he's going to be spending up to 20 more years in Guantanamo, never seeing his—
Or up to a lifetime. Isn't it up to a lifetime?
I'm not sure this sentence was life or 20, but a long time and never going back to Australia. So he's faced with that, with a completely unjust
system.
Never
seeing his kids again.
Right.
Never.
Unjust system, not seeing his kids, 20 years. At that point, he says, well, I'll plead guilty, and there's a deal made already, which he knew, to do any time that he gets served to in Australia. So you tell me. I mean, you're in that position. You've seen the Supreme Court reversed twice by our Congress in the habeas corpus issue. You've seen the Military Commission Act people set up this kangaroo court, which you could understand as an Australian because that's where the name came from. And you've seen his lawyers excluded. The guy is sitting there, and he's going to do his time in Australia. My bet is he doesn't do much time in Australia in the end, and that he gets out of prison very quickly in Australia.
Why do you think that?
Well, I think he's not going to get the full 20. I think he'll get a lower sentence. He'll get credit for time served. And there has been, partly because of Major Mori's work in going to Australia and seven times and rousing the population against what's happening to one of their citizens, that there's a lot of pressure in Australia now in favor of David Hicks and for not really treating him in a punitive way for something that in many people's view really didn't constitute a material aid to terrorism crime.
When did the U.S. stop giving CIA support to the Taliban? It's interesting that we're prosecuting people for things that our own government has done.
And of course,
we're backdating the war on terror. Can we backdate it to put some of those government officials who gave aid to the Taliban?
And of course,
in
Pakistan
prison?
Intelligence Agency, you know, they're all over the place.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, they're like, they have their fingers into everything. From terrorism to
Kashmir. Yeah, that's right.
To all over. So basically David Hicks is taking the hit for an intelligence agent that worked with the CIA for a very, very long time. Now, you know, the two poles of this are, you know, the government is putting this forward, or the Bush administration is, this shows that it works. What we have here works. That we can try people with these military commissions, et cetera. Now, in fact, if this is allowed to actually become part of our legal system, we're going to have two systems. We're going to have a system of, quote, at least on its face, just system, and then we're going to have a system of utter injustice. Their system, the one that they have, is picking up people anywhere in the world, taking them to Guantanamo.
Torturing them.
And then if and when they decide to try somebody, and they never have to try anybody, trying them before a kangaroo court. And the word court is a bad word to even attach to this process. So that's what we have now. And right now, of course, it's a system for most people, and then it's a system for Muslims. That's what we really have.
It's been a busy month in New York City. Among the many things that we've discovered lately is that there's been some very serious pre-RNC spying going on by the NYPD. We understand that the New York City Police Department was engaged in spying not only on local groups, including peace activists and people who were upset about the RNC happening, the Republican National Convention happening here in the summer of 2004 in New York City, but also the NYPD was engaged in spying on peaceful groups all around the country. We have with us Donna Lieberman of the NYCLU. Donna, what's going on?
Well, the Times reported that the police department was engaged in an international surveillance campaign to track not just suspicious activity in conjunction with the Republican National Convention, but to track perfectly lawful activity around the convention. And they were apparently tracking groups like bands for Bush. So now the police department thinks that they have the right to engage in political surveillance of a group that's mission is to organize rock concerts in opposition to the Bush administration and Billionaires for Bush, which is not their donor base, but a street theater group. The police department denies the allegations and is very upset that the information is out.
How did it get out? The New York Times leaked it out?
The New York Times got access to the information through its own sources. And my understanding is they have, you know, a lot more information than any of the lawyers involved in the lawsuits related to the Republican Convention bad arrests. And there are dozens of those lawsuits, including, you know, some people represented by the NYCLU. But we don't know how the Times got the information. What's interesting is that the police department has not denied the story, and the police department has also said that it doesn't want any of the information to be made public because they believe that the public won't get it. They will misinterpret the police records and, I guess, assume the worst about the police department's activities.
I mean, Donna, to me, that they could actually put forth a reason like that for not turning over the records shows the times that we've come to. They're not saying they're secret because they're informants that we don't want to disclose, which they can always take out the names. They're actually saying that the public can't understand these records, and and what they're really saying is we're going to be totally embarrassed by this, or
absolutely
mortified, or prosecuted.
It's a less than clever spin on the secrecy compulsion of the NYPD. The NYPD doesn't like to be held accountable, doesn't like to put any sunshine on its activities, and this is kind of a transparent attempt at defense.
Was this just the NYPD, or were there other agencies working with them? Is this across the country? Were there infiltrators? What was it?
Questions have been raised about what other law enforcement groups were involved. We were told before the convention that there were dozens of law enforcement groups doing security around the convention, but we only focused on the NYPD. I think that there's concern that the NYPD was sharing information with other law enforcement groups as well.
I mean, if the NYPD is spying on groups around the country, that they would need help of another agency to help them get access to other groups in Colorado, California, Hawaii, wherever it is. Yeah, I think the FBI might be involved. And if we're talking internationally, we're dealing with a whole nother agency.
Right. I think that's the assumption. And, you know, hopefully the court will allow the documents that have been turned over to the RNC lawyers. I don't mean the RNC lawyers, the lawyers for the people challenging the arrests of the RNC, to see the light of day. And hopefully we'll get more information about that.
Go over with us some of the details of what we do know. You mentioned earlier that the NYPD apparently was investigating some peaceful groups. Tell us what we know about that.
Well, let me tell you one thing that wasn't in the Times. We had a press conference the other day in which we invited a young woman, Jennifer Flynn, to speak. Jennifer was the lead organizer for the Still We Rise demonstration, which happened on the Monday of the convention. It was a perfectly peaceful, lawful demonstration as it was being organized, having to do with the rights of low-income people, people with AIDS, Rockefeller drug laws, etc. The day before the convention, the day before her demonstration, she was out in New Jersey visiting her parents and her sister, and she noticed on this small suburban New Jersey street a carload of people who didn't look like they belonged there. You know, your stereotypical undercover cops in suits, suited undercover cops. And she was surprised and shocked, and she was even more shocked and a little bit freaked out when she left her parents' house, they followed her to the Lincoln Tunnel or the Holland Tunnel, I forget which one, and then parked outside her house when she got home. We could never confirm that she was being followed by the police, but we have no question but that she was. We don't know exactly what they were doing in following around billionaires for Bush. You know, I mean, maybe they needed a good show, you know, or a good laugh. They had some clever stuff starring Mega Bucks and others, what kind of music they wanted to listen to. We know sort of nationally that law enforcement and, you know, to the people who are the targets of it, it really doesn't matter whether it's the NYPD or the Justice Department, the FBI, you know, and whether it's Gonzalez or Ashcroft. We know that what they think of as terrorism, we know that they don't distinguish between classic protest activity, lawful protest, and terrorism, that they were spying on the Fresno Peace Organization, that they were spying on a Quaker organization in Philly. So all of us have cause to be just as paranoid as people were in the 50s, and just as paranoid as people should have been in the 60s and 70s about the fact that they're spying on us. And when they spy on us and when they infiltrate our organizations, we know they're collecting dossiers on people to release selectively and to hurt people and to get back at people who were critics. And we also have to worry about them being agents provocateurs. And so it's back to the bad old days.
There's two lawsuits I know. There's the whole set around the RNC, the Republican National Convention. Everybody's representing people who were spied on and arrested, et cetera. And then there's the Handschuh case, that, you know, 30-year-old case that, you know, put limits on what the police department in New York could do. What do you expect to happen next? Are we going to actually get to the bottom of what happened?
Well, in the context of the Republican National Convention litigation, those lawsuits, the Civil Liberties Union and the other lawyers have been given documents that talk about the intelligence activities. There's a battle going on with the judge now about whether those documents can be released to the public. The last set of documents that was provided under a protective order from the court has, in fact, largely been released to the public. Those aren't intelligence documents. With regard to the Hanshu litigation, it's our view that if indeed the police department was spying on lawful political activity, they're in contempt of the Hanshu order, even as modified post 9/11. And so the Hanshu lawyers, including Civil Liberties Union lawyers, are meeting to figure out exactly what the next steps will be. But this is, you know, we recently won in the Hanshu case a limitation on the pervasive video surveillance that the police department is engaged in. So this is going to be, you know, yet another chapter in the unending class action known as Hanshu.
It certainly is unending. Yes. I was at least one of the targets of the Hanshu case early on when in the 70s at the law, law school.
Right.
So
yeah.
There you are. Well, thank you, Donna, for that.
Thanks.
In a very small effort to lighten up things here on Law and Disorder, we're going to read you a couple of lawyer jokes. As you know, the four of us who host this program are all lawyers. And occasionally, Michael, like Smith, likes to say, well, these are lawyers you'll like. Well, these are from a book called Disorder in the American Courts and are things people actually said in court, word for word, taken down and now published by court reporters. Let me read you one to get you started. The attorney. In court, remember. Now, doctor, isn't it true that when a person dies in his sleep, he doesn't know about it until the next morning? I can't even. Witness. Witness. Did you actually. Witness. Did you actually pass the bar exam? Attorney. How is your first marriage terminated? Witness. By death. Attorney. And by whose death was it And by whose death was it terminated? Attorney, all your responses must be oral, okay? What school did you go to? Witness, oral. Attorney, do you recall the time that you examined the body? Witness, the autopsy stated around 8:30 p.m. Attorney, and Mr. Denton was dead at the time? Witness. No, he was sitting. Witness. No, he was sitting on the table wondering why I was doing an autopsy on him. And the best for last, attorney. Doctor, before you performed the autopsy, did you check for a pulse? Witness. No. Attorney, did you check for blood pressure? No. Attorney. Did you check for breathing? Doctor witness, no. Attorney, so then it is possible that the patient was alive when you began the autopsy? No. How can you be so sure, doctor? Witness, because his brain was sitting on a... Witness, because his brain was sitting on my desk in a jar. Attorney, but could the patient have still been alive nevertheless? Witness, yes, it is possible that he could have been alive and practicing law.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show.
I think most of us listening to this show are aware of the racial profiling and special targeting that goes on against African Americans, Hispanics, and Muslims throughout this country. Today we're going to bring you a special story about a recently released New York statistic on the number of people who were stopped and frisked and arrested in New York City in this last year. Incredibly, 500,000 people on the city streets were stopped by the New York City Police Department. The statistics from 2006 show a near doubling in the number of arrests as a result of those stops. Of those 500,000 people stopped, a disproportionate number, 55%, were Black and 30% were Hispanic. As mentioned here at length on prior Law and Disorder programs, the New York Police Department, NYPD, continues to build a database on each street stop, a database with information most likely shared with intelligence agencies around the world. Today, we're joined to discuss this important topic by New York Civil Liberties Executive Director Donna Lieberman, and on the phone, Deborah Small, the Executive Director of Break the Chains, an organization that seeks to build a national movement within communities of color against punitive drug policies. Welcome, Donna and Deborah, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
So we learned that recently that last year the NYPD stopped more than 500,000 people on city streets, and we're seeing that a grossly disproportionate number of those people are Black, 55%, and 30% Hispanic. Let's start with you, Deborah. What do we know about this report that's been released?
Well, other than the actual numbers, we don't know a whole lot, except for the fact that we do know that the number of stops, which totaled almost over 500,000, did not yield arrests anywhere near proportionate to the number of people stopped. If you counted the actual arrest and summonses that issued as a result of those stops, collectively, it was about 50,000. So that means that there were at least 450,000 stops and frisks that did not result in a summons or an arrest. And
my math's bad. What is that? 5-10%?
It's like
10%.
10%.
Yeah.
So you mean they're stopping and frisking. For every 10 people they stop and frisk, they're getting
one
person who they actually make an arrest, and we don't know how many of those arrests actually hold up in court.
No, less than one for an arrest. It's like half. It's like 5% results in arrest, and another 5% results in a summons, which means like a desk appearance ticket for something minor, like loitering or open container violation or whatever. So the number of summonses, I believe, issued were about 29,000, and the number of arrests were 21,000.
They're stopping people in huge numbers who apparently they have no reason to stop. What's going on?
Well, I think it's what has been going on in the city for a very long time, which is the constant racial profiling of youth of color. I mean, while the numbers don't give you the age demographics, there's lots of anecdotal evidence to show that the principal targets of this type of policing have been young Black males and young Latino males, and that this has been done under the guise of quality of life policing. It's been happening since before Giuliani, but it's definitely was stepped up since then. And if you combine the stop and frisk policy with the disproportionate level of marijuana arrests in New York, what you see is a concerted effort to target youth of color and to find any means by which to either arrest them or find some other justification for getting their information into the city's criminal database.
Isn't it true, Deborah, that while statistically whites are more likely to use marijuana than African Americans, that 90% of the marijuana arrests that go on in New York City are people of color?
Over the last 10 years, New York has led the country in the number of marijuana possession arrests, and our data shows that a good 85 to 89% of those arrests are of youth of color, people under the age of 25, between the ages of 16 and 25. And no one would ever argue any more than they do with other drug arrests that they represent the overwhelming majority of the people who are using marijuana. And we really believe that these tactics, while they're being done under the guise of quality of life, that it's really coming out of under a theory that these youth, if they haven't committed crimes now, they will in the future, and so it's important for the police to try to gather as much information about them as possible.
Now, Donna, from the NYCLU point of view, you do some work on this issue as well, stop and frisk. What's your perception of what's really going on here? Is it similar to what Deborah's saying?
Yeah, it is. Not only are we seeing a dramatic increase, a fivefold increase from 4 years ago or 5 years ago in the number of stops and frisks, we're also seeing a dramatic increase in the number of baseless stops and frisks. We look at what's called the arrest to stop ratio, and where that was 5.5 to 1 back in 2002, it's now 10 to 1. So almost twice as many people are now being stopped for doing nothing wrong other than being on the street while being, for the most part, black.
We have this number of 500,000 people being subjected to stop and frisks. Mm-hmm. Of that, we have 50,000 actually being arrested. Is that?
No, it's actually 20,000 arrests and 29,000 summonses. So it's about 50,000 people who have been charged with doing something wrong, something major or something right. Very, very minor. And by the way, it has to be really, really minor these days in order to get a summons, because
they put everybody
through the system that they
right.
can.
So you're saying it's 10 to 1 now. For every stop, there's one person either arrested or given
arrested.
A summons.
Arrested. It's slightly lower for the if you include
right.
the summonses.
Right. And then in the old days, in 2002, there were 100,000 people stopped, basically.
Right.
So you're already going up five times.
Right. So I think we've become a society where, you know, ratios tell you one thing. They tell you sort of like that there are a lot more bad stop and frisks. But the absolute numbers are just astounding, because it tells us that we're living in something that's really, at least in the black community, approaching a police state. Because the likelihood of being stopped for doing nothing wrong is increasing exponentially.
Deborah, what's your perception of that?
Well, I believe that Donna's absolutely right, and I had that confirmed for me about 3 or 4 years ago when my son came back home one day after he had left to go to work, and I asked him why he came back, and he told me because he forgot his driver's license, which I asked him about because he wasn't driving anywhere. And he told me then that he never left the house without his driver's license, because if the police stopped him and he didn't have his ID with him, I'd have to come down to the precinct to pick him up. And I have to say that when I heard that, I realized that at least for black and brown men in New York City, they feel like they are living under the same kind of passcodes that were endemic during apartheid South Africa, that you could not be on the street without identification, without risking arrest.
One of the pieces of data that we looked at is sort of the relationship between the stop-to-arrest ratio for blacks as against whites. And for blacks, it's like 20% higher. That tells us that you're far more likely to be stopped for no reason if you're a black person walking down the street than if you're. That should raise the flag of profiling, not just for people like us, but for people on the city council and the people who are supposed to be holding the police department accountable for fair and just policing. You know, it's ironic. Right after September 11th, the police department passed a new regulation prohibiting racial profiling. You knew that it was a whitewash, as it were. You knew that they were doing this more for appearances' sake than for any reality in terms of changes in police style.
You know, when we were at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we after the murder of Diallo, we brought a case to stop, really, essentially racial profiling in African-American communities and Hispanic communities. It was a unit called the Special Crimes Unit that did exactly this, went into a black community, saw young people, and just shook them up, went up to them, stop and frisk them. And we actually got an order saying you can't run a special crimes unit.
There's a 2006 report by the ACLU, and actually it was quoted by Arianna Huffington in a piece that she wrote for the LA Times. And she says, or the report says, that African Americans make up an estimated 15% of drug users, but they account for 37% of those arrested on drug charges, 59% of those convicted, and 74% of all drug offenders sentenced to prison. Deborah, can you tell us a little bit more about the intersection between racial profiling and drug enforcement?
Well, the reality is that the war on drugs, which we've been fighting pretty relentlessly for the past 20, 25 years, is in fact a war on communities of color. From the very inception, and particularly so since the advent of the quote-unquote crack epidemic, drug use in this country has been racialized so that it's overly associated with people of color. Now, all of the government surveys that they've done over the years show that blacks and Latinos don't use drugs at any rate greater than any other group in society. And yet the majority of drug law enforcement has focused on communities of color. Now, initially, it was said that they were doing that in order to protect the community because there was a large amount of drug-related violence, et cetera. Whether or not you bought that argument in 85 or 86, it's definitely clear that it no longer holds today. There's been a substantial decrease of violence associated with drug markets, and yet there's been an increase in drug arrests. And from our point of view, what the drug war actually is in practice is a justification for taking and continuing to marginalize large numbers of black and brown people, take them out of the economic system by incarcerating them and then hampering them with all kinds of post-conviction sanctions that make it impossible for them to compete economically. And it takes the onus away from government, from looking at some of the real conditions of poverty, lack of education, lack of job opportunities that are plaguing inner city communities. Under the guise of the drug war, we can say, well, the reason that these communities have this problem is because too many of them are either using drugs or selling drugs, and it's their fault that they're in that condition, and the rest of society gets off the hook for addressing the very real endemic problems that are there and that have continued to be there and that are only made worse by our drug policies. I also want to add that one of the many perverse side effects of our punitive drug policy is the increasing rate of HIV/AIDS that you see in African American communities, which is directly related to our unwillingness to provide funding for needle exchange and other interventions that will limit the ability or the likelihood that people who use drugs will get infected with HIV or hepatitis C.
Deborah, we started out this conversation by talking about the recent report that shows that NYPD, once again, something we already knew, is racial profiling every day out there on the streets. How much of this is a national problem?
Well, you know, we've been doing at our organization looking at the whole issue of racial disparity in marijuana arrests, which is an issue that most people don't pay attention to because they don't think that there's a lot of sanctions attached to being arrested for marijuana. But what we've seen is that after New York, Baltimore, Atlanta lead the country in arresting people for marijuana possession, that the overwhelming number of these arrests, anywhere between 75 and 90%, are of youth of color, even though their rate of use is no higher than their white counterparts, and that this policy does a couple of things. One, it keeps the police busy. And I mean, I know that it's considered sacrilege to say this, but one of the problems in New York is that we have too many police with not enough to do. And so going around arresting people for marijuana, one, allows their drug stat numbers to look good, and two, it keeps them busy in an activity that they don't consider to be particularly dangerous. But more importantly, it continues to reinforce the notion that you have high levels of criminality that's centered in communities of color, that it's tied up one way or another with drugs and drug-related activity, and justifies continuing to spend billions and billions of dollars on a war on drugs that we're not winning and never can win.
Don, I have a question for you. We're thinking about talking about stop and frisks. I mean, I just have a feeling that if a cop came up to you, even me, a white lawyer here, and said, can I see your identification? And I said, do I have a choice? He was going to say, no, you don't. I want to see your identification. Or if I tried to walk away, he would say, that's suspicion.
You're absolutely right, Michael. But the question is, like, what happens as a result? If you as a white lawyer walk away, the chances are, I'm not sure how much greater, but somewhat greater, that you'll be able to walk away.
Right. I won't get shot in the
back. Than if you're an 18-year-old black kid.
Right.
This is about survival. The unfortunate thing for kids of color in New York City is that, you know, their parents and schools have to teach them how to survive. It's not just surviving by, you know, sort of all the what you would think would be the trials and tribulations of adolescence. It's how to survive the cops, because if they are kids of color, by definition, they are suspects in the eyes of the cops. It happens on the street. It happens in the schools.
And Deborah, you heard what Donna's advice is. I presume you give similar advice, but I know you meet a lot of young people like Donna does, and what do you say to them?
Well, I have to say I'm of two minds about this, and I'm always very torn because on one hand, as a parent and as a community resident, you do want the kids to survive and have minimal problems with the police. And so the easiest thing to do is to comply with those kinds of requests. But I have to say that I'm often very troubled at giving that type of advice because it's like telling young people that they should accept second-class justice in their society because they know that their white counterparts are not treated the same way. And so every time we tell them that they should go along with the police when questioned, we're telling them that they should accept the reality of being treated differently. And so depending on where I am and what group of young people I'm talking to, where there's enough of them to be able to resist and to be able to express their upset about the way in which they're being racially profiled, I encourage them to do that and to organize around it. And the other thing I wanted to add is that in addition to this happening on the streets, we're increasingly seeing the police using these same stop and frisk tactics in housing projects, in public housing throughout the city. They do now what's called verticals, where they go into the building and they go up and down the elevators or the stairs looking for anyone they think may be trespassing. So if you're living in a big housing complex and you go to visit a friend in another building or a relative in another building, if the police stop you there and you can't prove where you live or that someone in that building knows you, then you're subject to being arrested for trespassing. They don't do that in white communities.
Thank you, Deborah. I'm sitting here with, the listeners can't see it, but Donna is opening a little folder that appears to me to be a rights folder. Donna, why don't you mention what it is?
Yeah, the Civil Liberties Union puts out a pamphlet that fits in your pocket called What to Do If You're Stopped by the Police, and we give these out in conjunction with Know Your Rights workshops that we do with community groups and groups of young people. The nice thing, it's available on the NYCLU website, nyclu.org. What's good about it is it contains... in plain English, a list of people's rights in various situations in dealing with the police, and also some practical do's and don'ts. This is a real problem for young people, and we're trying to sort of help them, you know, survive it.
What are the possibilities? What can people do to actually change the situation in New York or in other cities in the country? First to you, Deborah, and then to you, Donna.
One of the things is that adults, we have to be more accountable for what our police are doing. The fact that the NYPD got away without providing statistics, even though they're required to do so by law for more than 2.5 years, is a lack of accountability both on their part and on the part of the public for demanding it. The fact that in 1999, when he was still Attorney General, Elliot Spitz issued a report about the stop and frisk policies, which at that point were only a quarter as bad as they are today, and he identified that as a major civil liberties violation. In the intervening years, very little has happened. In fact, the situation has gotten worse. So I would hope that if he still means the same things that he said in 1999, that he would actually look at this report and be appalled and demand that there were changes made in the NYPD's policing practices.
Thank you, Deborah. And Donna?
Well, what we're working on is, you know, we've urged actually the Attorney General's office to issue a new report and do a thorough analysis of the latest stop and frisk data. The police department came clean with the 2006 data, but it still owes us 2004 and 2005. We shouldn't be letting up on the pressure to meet their legal obligations and come clean with the public in terms of, you know, stop and frisk policies, practices. I think it's important that we push for a meaningful CCRB and fix the problems there.
What's
which
the CCRB?
The Civilian Complaint Review Board. And we need to be pushing the Civilian Complaint Review Board to be expanding its jurisdiction to cover the schools where lots of kids are getting harassed and abused by the police every day, and they have no place to go with the complaints of abuse. The biggest thing we need to be pushing for, however, is like the repeal of the Rockefeller drug laws. If there's one thing that is responsible for the incarceration oppression of people of color more than anything else. It's these ridiculous Rockefeller drug laws that over-incarcerate, that shouldn't be punishing simple drug use, and which are inflating the populations of upstate communities so that they have even greater representation than their ordinary populations would allow. Thousands and thousands and thousands of mainly men and women of color.
And I know, Deborah, this is an important issue for your organization as well, right?
Yes, it is. And the one thing I'd like to add is, one, you know, this Congress is again looking at whether or not it should change the crack powder sentencing disparity, which everyone has agreed for the last 10 years is unjustified and has only increased the number of people of color who've ended up behind bars. But I think ultimately it's been very interesting to me to look at the way the conversation about drugs and addiction has shifted in society. The fact that you have HBO and A&E doing all of these shows about addiction where the people are white and yet the issue of criminal justice sanctions is hardly ever present tells us that we have two different systems for dealing with drugs in this country. If you're a white person or affluent person and you have an addiction problem, you'll get to go to treatment, you'll have your family support, you'll even have sometimes the support of local law enforcement to get you in treatment. If you're a person of color and you have any involvement with drugs at all, even something as minor as smoking a small amount of marijuana, what we have for you is a cell and a criminal record. And I think that that, to me, represents the most blatant form of racism, and it's time for us to change it.
Okay, well, we've been speaking with Deborah Small, executive director of an organization that she founded called Break the Chains, and with Donna Lieberman, the executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Thank you very much. I, who live in New York, was really shocked by a lot of the statistics and the numbers. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.